Okay, hi everybody. We are going to start. Please mute yourselves. Questions that you have, I'm so happy to see in the chat. I see somebody already commented about what we had the conversation before, that we did get a lot of produce from Gaza, but obviously that's not happening at the moment. And we do get stuff from Turkey, although there's been a campaign. Happy Tu B'Shvat, everybody, by the way. It's Tu B'Shvat here already in Israel. A lot of our dried fruit comes from Turkey, and there's been a campaign to not buy that this year, but to buy only Israeli grown fruit, not so much dried fruit. We don't do that much so much here, but fresh Israeli fruit. Okay. Hi, everyone. Today's learning is sponsored by Carol Damon in memory of her mother, Rose Goldberg, Brain Erasel Bat Avram, on the occasion of her Yahrzeit, which is the 14th of Shvat, which by you guys in Canada, it still is the 14th of Shvat. The series has been sponsored by Sharon and Marty Goldberg in loving memory of Sharon's father, Yechezkel ben Yerachmiel, on the occasion of his 15th Yahrzeit, on the 11th of Shvat. Yehi Zichro Baruch. And of course, all our learning, as always, is dedicated to the safe return of the hostages, to the refuah shleimah, of the wounded, and to the success of our soldiers. Very, very hard day that we all had yesterday, and we hope for better days. Okay, let's get started. We are on our third class, and today we're going to get more into the modern period. I apologize for my voice. I've had a terrible cold all week. We talked more about Tanakh and medieval times last time. Now we're going to get into the story of what we call in Hebrew, Medinah Shebaderech, a state in the making. And this is going to be not about Gaza, but about the areas on the outside, what we call the Gaza envelope, the northern Negev, and how significant those were in pre-state days and also in that first year during the time of the War of Independence. Very important in terms of settling the Negev, as we're going to see. Settling the Negev is one of the crucial challenges of Zionism, one that we don't come to in the very beginning of Zionism, but becomes very important as time goes on. And it's also going to be very important in terms of the battles of the War of Independence. These communities are on the main road for Egypt coming up the coast, headed towards Tel Aviv, and they provide much needed pushback against the Egyptian forces, and we're going to see that as we go through the slides today. We have a lot of stories of valor from these communities in the area of the northern Negev. So the picture that we're looking at here is a picture of the fighters in Nirim, the story of Nirim, the first place in the northern Negev that's attacked the day after the state is declared. We'll come to that about halfway through the class. Okay, as always, let's take a look at our timeline. And one of the things that's important to understand about this timeline is going to come up a lot. I put in the whole timeline here. We're really only going to talk about up until 1948, and we'll save the rest of it for our next few classes. But what's important to understand is that in the first waves of Jewish settlement, right, the first Aliyah, the second Aliyah, the third Aliyah, the Negev is almost completely off of the Jewish radar, right? For various reasons, it's harder to settle. There's not natural resources. The land is not being sold as readily, and so those first communities, as we're going to see, are not in the Negev, except with a very few exceptions here and there. And that's going to become something that needs to change very desperately in the 1940s. Okay, so that's just to keep that in mind as we look through this timeline. Modern Beersheba, right? We talked about Beersheba and Tanakh in our first class. Modern Beersheba is founded by the Turks only at the beginning of the 20th century in an attempt to kind of contain the Bedouin. and not allow them to roam all over the Negev. It has very few Jewish settlers, but it begins in 1900. 1911, 1912, we have the first and for a time only Jewish settlement in the northern Negev, Ruchama. We'll tell that story in a minute. World War I, 1917, the British take Be'er Sheva and Gaza from the Turks, but at the same time, that's a good thing for the Jewish community, but Ruchama is destroyed. Attempts to rebuild, but riots in 1929, riots in 1936. The Jews leave Be'er Sheva, and there's essentially almost no Jewish settlement in the Negev. Very important turning point, 1937, the Peel Commission, right? The British decide to have a partition plan drawn up, and the Peel Commission allocates the Negev to a future Arab state. They take a look at the map of settlement and they say, there's no Jews there. No Jews there. We don't need to give it to the Jewish state. And that is the jump start for the Jewish Yishuv to start to build and to settle in the Negev despite the white papers of the British forbidding it. Okay, so we have Negba founded in 1939, 1940 setback of the British forbidding land purchase, but the Jews go ahead anyway. 1943, three mitzpim. We'll explain what that is in a little bit. Huge jump forward the night between October 5th and 6th, 1946, what's called the Achat Esrei Nekudot Banegev, 11 new communities founded overnight. Those communities, of course, need water. And in 1947, we have the pipeline that's laid to these communities. The Negev is besieged in the War of Independence. On May 15th, 1948, when the armies around us attack, Egypt attacks and advances on the communities of Nirim, Yad Mordechai. We'll tell those stories. But by December 1948, the Negev is conquered completely by Israel, but not Gaza. Gaza stays in Egyptian hands. Okay, the rest of the timeline, like I said, we'll come back to in our next class. So in order to understand pattern of Jewish settlement, I brought you this map here on the left. This map is from 1944, so it doesn't completely showcase for us the reality of a Negev empty of Jewish presence. There already are a few dots down here because that's when we have those few communities that are beginning to be founded. But in general, if you take a look, where are the Jewish communities? The Jewish communities are essentially in the shape of a letter N, right? They are along the coast, across the Jezreel Valley and up into the eastern part of the Galilee. These are the places that Jews are able to buy land. These are the places where they begin farming communities, as well as the city of Tel Aviv, the towns of Gedera, Rishon LeZion, right? But these are the places that are settled in the beginning. They don't settle in two very significant places. First of all, the mountains, right? The mountains are not settled by Jews in this first wave. Why? Because historically, for the centuries preceding Zionism, this is where the Arabs have settled, right? Excuse me. Apologize. Not good to teach while you have a bad sore throat. These areas became Arab controlled after the Mamluks take over from the Crusaders, destroy the cities of the coast, and they move inland. And the cities of the coast and the areas of the Jezreel Valley are abandoned, turn into swampland, turn into junk. And when the Jews come at the end of the 19th century, absentee Arab landlords are only too happy to sell them these lands at inflated prices. But they're not selling those lands in the mountains. So that's an area that's not settled by Jews, at least in that first wave. And we hear about Gush Etzion a little bit later. And the area of the Negev is not settled. The picture on the right is a picture of Be'er Sheva. Okay, Be'er Sheva in 1917. Okay. Who sells them land is the landowners, the Arab landowners. Who are mostly living in places like Beirut and Damascus. They're absentee landlords. They have no interest in living in the backwater that is Palestine. And so they're happy to make a buck off of these crazy Jews who want to live in these places. Early Be'er Sheva, anyone who knows Be'er Sheva in the last 20, 30 years, This is a great picture because Beersheba is today a very large, very cosmopolitan city. Even though the center of the old part of town still looks like this, which is kind of cool. I mean, it doesn't completely look like this, but you still have the same monument, same main street. Okay, so that's Beersheba. Let's move on to our first Jewish community that is in the Negev. Let's understand our locations a little bit. Okay, so we are talking, like we said in the first class, we're talking about the northern Negev and specifically the northwestern Negev. Nobody is thinking about going south to Beersheba. That's a vision that's only going to happen much later. There's no possibility, there's no technology, there's no water that could make that happen. So we are talking about the northwestern Negev. So we have this area of Gaza and Gaza City, which we mentioned has some Jewish settlement, but not very much. Okay. But we are going to be discussing Ruchama. That's our first community that we have here. Okay. Further north, the closest Jewish community to Ruchama, when Ruchama is founded in 1911, 1912, is Be'er Tuvia, all the way 40 kilometers to the north here by what's called Summit Castina, very far away. So Ruchama is exceedingly isolated. Okay. Eventually we're going to have the kibbutzim and the moshavim of Be'eri, of Nirim, right? All of these areas down around over here. But in the beginning, Ruchama really stands alone. So just to understand where it is, we are kind of due west of Gaza City. These are places that are very much on the map today. This is kind of the layer that's outside, one layer outside of the Gaza envelope, right? Here's Sderot, just to give you kind of a frame of reference. Sderot, Netivot, right? Ofakim down in this direction. So just to understand where we are talking about. Okay. What is the story behind Ruchama? So in, sorry, let's just get rid of this. Ruchama is in an area that is very lush. Okay. You can get a sense. Take a look at the picture on the left. This area is called Bitronot Ruchama, the Badlands of Ruchama. This over here in the corner, this is the actual kibbutz of Ruchama today, which is a nice small kibbutz. We'll talk about how it, ended up. But this area is a beautiful nature reserve on the outskirts. Today, this time of year, this is all covered in beautiful kalaniyot, anemones all over the place. Sorry, go back one. And this area is called Badlands, Bitronot. It's kind of the way the formation of the land is. It means the soil is very lush. It's very good for growing things. And there definitely were communities here before our story begins in the 20th century. In the 50s, as part of the expansion of Ruchama, there was an archaeological excavation. As you can see here on the right, we have pretty typical mosaic floor. This goes back to Byzantine times, 1500 years ago. There was a Byzantine monastery here. There are scholars who suggest that there was a Jewish town earlier than that, Roman times, right? So this is definitely a place that is appropriate for settlement, okay? The Hachsharat HaYishuv, the Zionist organization that buys land, bought a piece of land in 1911, 6,000 dunam, nice sized piece of land, with the idea already 30 years before their time of expanding to the Negev. Okay, so they buy this land, but now they need people who are going to work it. The group in Russia, based in Moscow, called Agudat She'erit Yisrael. They are businessmen. They buy it from the Hachsharat HaYishuv, and they decide to create a community that's called Ruchama. What's Ruchama? Ruchama comes from the book of Hosea, right, in Tresar, where God, he tells Hosea to marry a woman, and just she's unfaithful to him, and he has a child who's called Lo Ruchama. I won't have mercy on you. And eventually, when God and Israel, or Hosea and his wife, are reconciled, he says, "I'm going to call Lo Ruchama Ruchama. I'm going to have mercy on her." So they decide to call this Moshav, Ruchama. they need somebody who's going to manage it and to work it, right? The owners are these guys who live in Moscow, but they're not coming to work the land. It's actually an interesting model. It's not something we see in places like Rishon LeZion or Zichron Yaakov. So this fellow here is named Zvi Hirschfeld. He, as much as he looks like an Arab, very traditional looking Arab, he's a Jew. Ashkenazi Jew, lived in Rishon LeZion. He decides to take on the job of being the manager of this chava, of this farm. People who have good memories may remember from last time we talked about the pillar from the Gaza synagogue that he managed to buy and that ended up on his tombstone. This is the same guy. Okay? So Zvi Hirschfeld starts to run the place. They get workers. They have to commit to having only Jewish labor, to having rights for the workers. They start to build. They build some buildings, though one of the only one that still exists today is what you see in the picture here in the middle. They dig a well. In 1914, they find water, which of course is huge, incredibly important. They plant almond trees. They have the inauguration of the yeshuv on the first day of Hanukkah, 1912. Okay, so Ruchama is taking off. It's doing very well. Even though the local Bedouins steal from them, they manage to get guards from the Hashomer organization, and they're doing pretty well. In fact, they're doing so well that Zvi Hirschfeld goes back to Russia, goes to these investors. He says, listen, we want to expand. I want to sell the land to the workers and make it a workers' community. They invest more money. Everybody's doing okay. And then what happens? The disasters, the double disaster, really the triple disaster that comes in the wake of World War I. Okay. Number one, a disaster that's from nature, nothing to do with the war, but that's what you see over here. The picture on the left, 1915. There's a huge locust plague in the land of Israel. It's a terrible, terrible thing. Locust plagues, right? Parsha last week. Locusts can come, a swarm of locusts can come and strip everything from a field in a few minutes. So all of this very difficult, hard-won labor that the workers of Ruchama did to raise crops, gone with the locusts. Okay. Next thing that happens, a human plague. World War I has already begun. Turkish soldiers essentially rampaging through the land need to have, again, locust plague, no more food, need to have supplies. Here they see this community kind of in the middle of nowhere. They say, ah, this is a good place for us to camp and to use their water and to use their food. They use it as a base. They expel a lot of the citizens and they basically loot the place. So you have these twin crises of the war and the locusts. Added to that, you have this interesting fellow in the middle. Okay. This guy's name is Yosef Lishansky. Some of you might be familiar with that name from the story of Neeley in Zichron Yaakov, right? Neeley was a spy ring, a Jewish spy ring started by the Aronson family. You can see in the picture on the right here, Sarah Aronson, who was Sarah, the heroine of Neeley, right? They took information from the Turks and passed it to the British so that the British would be able to win World War I and kick the Turks out. This was a very, very, very dangerous operation. Yosef Lishansky was kind of one of the loose cannons of this organization. He comes down to Ruchama. He takes over the guarding duties in Ruchama, but he uses Ruchama as a base from which to spy on the Turkish soldiers. Remember, there are all these Turkish soldiers nearby. And so the Turk's suspicion is raised even more, right? So all of these really not good combination of events as things keep getting worse and worse and worse in Ruchama as the British are advancing on Gaza. The Turks come down to Ruchama literally the day before the British attack and take Beersheba. They arrest everyone in Ruchama. They bring them to Beersheba. Meanwhile, the soldiers come in and the Bedouin come in and they loot whatever's left. And that's really the end of Ruchama. There's nothing to come back to once these guys are freed. So there's nothing to come back to. There's an attempt in the 20s to resettle. 1929 riots. There's an attempt in the 30s to resettle. 1936 riots. It's only in 1943 that the organization of the Shomer HaTzair comes, and on the lands of Ruhama, they come and they create a new kibbutz, right? They give it the same name, Kibbutz Ruhama. Again, it becomes a center of kind of shady activities, shady good activities, right? The Haganah is, uses it as a base. They do a lot of their training exercises in the nature around, and the British are very aware of that. And at the end of August 1946, they come and they raid the kibbutz. There's a picture on the left here of the kibbutz dining room. They have 3 days of essentially ransacking the kibbutz, looking for weapons, arresting people, and causing lots and lots of trouble in Ruhama. But ultimately, Ruhama survives. Today, it's a thriving kibbutz, 750 people. Their economy is agriculture. They also have a brush factory. They also raise medical cannabis. And one of the more interesting little details, they, because they have all this beautiful land all around them, this nice empty land, they are a launching space for hot air balloons. So if you Google Ruhama, you'll see some gorgeous pictures of hot air balloons over the landscape. So that's Ruhama. Begun, failed, but came back again. Sorry, wrong direction. Okay. Let's go back to later in history. Let's go forward to later in history. With this publication of the White Paper in of the Peel Commission, excuse me, in 1937, the Jews have a wake-up call. They understand that if they don't start to settle the Negev, if they don't create facts on the ground, it's going to be very problematic for them, because even if the Peel Commission plan is not implemented, whatever plan in the future is going to happen, they're going to see there are no Jews living in the Negev, and so they need to go into action and start settling in the Negev. The first community that's built is a place called Negba. Negba is hardly the Negev, right? It's far to the north. It's not far from Kiryat Gat of today. It's like at the very, very entrance to the Negev. Very interesting, because we have the British forbidding Jewish land purchase through a settlement in the Negev. So what do the Jews do? And it's not only in the Negev, they do it in other places as well. They do a trick that's called Choma Umigdal, Tower and Stockade. Turkish law states that if you have an existing structure of a tower and a fence, then you cannot knock that down. That constitutes a community. It's a fait accompli, and you can't do anything to get rid of it. Okay, and that's what the Jews took advantage. They would come at night. They would very, very quickly set up some makeshift fence and tower. When the British patrol would come around the next day, oh, I'm sorry, this is a community that we've always had here. Okay, so this is what was done in Negba as well as in many other places around. It's a start, but it's not enough. All right. And so the next step is to create something that are called mitzpim. Okay. Mitzpim are essentially kind of lookouts, right? Before real communities are created, in 1943, there are these three small kind of experimental communities created. One is called Revivim. That's the picture that you see here on the right. Gvulot and Beit Eshel. The conditions are difficult. In terms of water, in terms of agriculture, but the concept is to kind of test the conditions, first of all, to see, can we actually raise anything here? They bought whatever land they could buy. They weren't particularly picky. And also to test the British. How will the British respond to this move that we do? So that was like a testing the waters. That's these three communities. They were very, very bare bones. You could see in the picture on the right here. Courtyard with a tower, 10 to 12 workers. They did a little farming, soil research, checking the climate conditions. And that was the beginning. But the real step forward was this crazy plan that was hatched to suddenly put 11 new communities on the map overnight. Again, taking advantage of this law of the tower and the stockade, what they did is they based themselves in some existing communities, like we see Ruhama over here, or Gvulot, right? Or Beit Eshel, right? And from there, Beirut Yitzchak also, if I'm remembering correctly, although here, Beirut Yitzchak, okay, sending groups of young people to these kind of staging grounds the day before, and at night going out all at once and setting up 11 new communities. The idea, of course, was to take the British by surprise. And so what they did is they chose a night that they figured the British would never suspect, the night between October 5th and October 6th, 1946. What was that? That was the end of Yom Kippur, right? Yom Kippur on October 5th, Motzei Yom Kippur. What they did is the day before, they sent groups, 25 boys, 5 girls for each community, sent them to these staging grounds at night, obviously very under the cover of darkness, going on, there are no real roads, right? Going on dirt paths, taking whatever they needed with them, and going out and setting up very, very basic communities. Some of those communities are still around today. One of them, Kfar Darom, was in the area of Gaza and was eventually in Gush Katif and then was moved to Kibbutz B'nai Darom. But the other ones, Nirim, Be'eri, Urim, Chatzirim, these are names that we hear today, right? That are still around, and we're going to hear about them when we talk about the 1948 story. So this was really an incredible, incredible project to take on. The next day, the newspapers in the Yishuv, the headline in one of them says, Yishuvei HaNegev nigalu mibdidutam. The communities of the Negev have been redeemed from their loneliness. So to go from really just a few isolated points on the map to suddenly having all of these was an amazing thing. However, they're not going to last very long without water. Okay? You have to have water for all of these communities. Some places, like we said, Ruchama was able to dig a well and find water, but a lot of these places had no water. So what are you going to do? And here's where we get to the unsung hero of this story. He's really very unsung, unfortunately. This was really the only picture I could find of him on Wikipedia. But he's such an important guy. This is Simcha Blass, right? Simcha Blass was a water engineer for Mikorot. As we're going to see, he was involved in water projects later on in the history of the state of Israel. And he understands that without water, none of this is possible. So he comes up with first a very, very brazen, crazy plan, which eventually becomes the national water carrier, right? Bringing water from the north, from the Kinneret down to these Yishuvim. That's not possible to do in the 1940s. So instead, he modifies this plan. There is a source of water that's discovered near this area called Nir Am, right, which is still a kibbutz that exists today. And what Blass does is he maps out and lays more than 220 kilometers of pipes reaching each and every one of these 11 communities that have been set up. So take a look at this. It's really an unbelievable thing. And by doing that, he brings water, which is life, to all of these places. Just an interesting little trivia. The pipes came from London, okay, a fire sale. They were used in London to put out fires during the Blitz during World War II, and then they weren't needed anymore. And the Yishuv buys them and lays these pipes, and these are the pipes that keep these communities going. When this is done, the national poet of the time, Natan Alterman, right? Natan Alterman wrote a lot of very serious, very heavy poems, but he also wrote a weekly poem based on current events called Hator HaShvi'i. And this is his poem about Simcha Blass and the waterline. It's called Concerto Latzinor, a concerto for a pipe. Lo pa'am nechleku de'ot chacham va'peti, et ha'historia mi oseh lemi yitaron. Not very often, not once, have the fools and the wise men disagreed. Who makes history? Who has the advantage? Echad machriz osimota kabinetim. One says it's the cabinet ministers. Sheni shar hapkidot. No, it's the bureaucrats. Shlishi to'en ha'hon. The third says no, it's the wealthy people. The oligarchs, Echad Tzach, one says the president, Echad Tzach, a senator, another one says the senator, Nachon, אך ייתכן כי עד לסוף דבר יוברר עוד שאותה עשה האינסטלטור אשר כיוון צינור עם ברז למדבר. They're all right, but it seems that in the end of the day, it's going to become clear that history is made by the plumber who pointed a pipe with a faucet towards the desert. Right? And that pipe with the faucet is the reason these communities can continue. Simcha Blass goes on to do two things which are incredibly important in the state of Israel. Together with Pinchas Sapir and Levi Eshkol, he creates the National Water Carrier. This huge infrastructure project that you can see here, which brings water from the Kinneret, basically the largest water reservoir we have in Israel, and brings it in pipes that with a reservoir along the way. This is the Eshkol Reservoir, bringing it down towards the center and the south of the country. Huge, huge undertaking for the early state and very, very, very significant. Later on in his life, he kind of fell out of favor. He didn't have a position in the government. He was looking for something to do. And he and his son developed drip irrigation. Right, drip irrigation, which has revolutionized agriculture not only in Israel, but in many, many countries that have water shortages. So Simcha Blass, the most famous water person you've never heard of. Okay, all of this work, right, all of this effort, bears fruit because what happens is if you compare these maps, the Peel Commission map in 1937, you can see the pink is all the area given to the Arabs, meaning all of the area of Judea and Samaria, all of the area of the Negev, only this small international corridor to Jerusalem, and only this small part of this two-thirds of the coast and the Galilee given to the Jewish state. The UN partition plan 10 years later, also not a great plan, but a huge difference in that the UN gives the entire Negev or almost the entire Negev to the future Jewish state. And that's because they came and they saw what the Jews accomplished with these communities, with the farming that they were able to do, with the water. So very, very significant. Ultimately, you could say, okay, maybe it wasn't so significant because we didn't follow this plan in the end. But it was significant because these communities are the ones that are on the front lines in the battle in 1948. And that's the story that we're going to tell now, the second half of our story. So war breaks out. The first half of the war, of course, is from the day after partition is declared, November 30th, 1947, until the state is declared May 14th, 1948. That's local gangs, local Arabs backed up by Arab countries, but the Arab countries can't invade until the British leave and Israel declares itself a state. In that first half of the war, there's a lot of sabotage, right? There's no official attacks from Arab countries. There are attacks by the local Arabs on the Jews, but there's sabotage. And of course, the Negev is ripe for sabotage of water because we just saw these water pipes, very, very important, but very isolated, very fragile, very easy to sabotage. So the Yishuv has to spend way too much time and manpower and effort in protecting these water lines. And that's what they have to do. The other picture that you have here is a picture of the dining room of Kibbutz Nirim. In a minute, we're going to see why Kibbutz Nirim is on the front lines. But take a look at the sign that's on the wall in the dining room. Later, we're going to see it on the memorial for Kibbutz Nirim. It says, Lo ha-tank yinatzeach ki'im ha-adam. It's not the tank that's victorious, but the person. Okay? This is a version of the slogan is what the tank corps uses today. It's not the technology. And this is something we unfortunately have seen quite a lot of in the last few months. It's not the technology. It's the people. Right? It's the people with their intelligence, with their bravery. They are the ones that are going to be victorious. In Kibbutz Nirim, that had no tanks and had no technology, it was not only a wise saying, it was an essential saying. They didn't have any other choices. So what happens? When Israel declares itself a state on May 14th, the very next day, of course, the Arabs can attack from Arab countries, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Iraq. We are interested at this point in Egypt, okay? Egypt wants to reach the center of the country, the main populations areas of the country, on two different routes. One is going up through the center of the Negev, through Be'er Sheva, right, through Gush Etzion, heading towards Jerusalem, Ramat Rachel. Okay, but we are going to talk about the route that goes essentially along the coast. Okay, and they're going to encounter Jewish resistance. Okay, they could have gone just through Gaza, but they want to attack the Jewish communities along the way. They don't want to leave them standing. And so they're going to encounter Jewish resistance from Nirim, from Be'erot Yitzchak, from Yad Mordechai, etc., as they make their way with the hope of reaching Tel Aviv. So with this map, I hope it's clear that we are very much on the front lines here. And the very first place to be attacked is Nirim. Okay, on May 15th, Nirim, which is a kibbutz that was made, we saw one of the 11 points, but it's built on land that was originally purchased by a Jew at the early part of the 20th century, somebody named Shlomo Dangur. It has a small group of defenders who do everything possible to fight off the Egyptian advance. They put out signs of mines. They shoot from different places, right? There are all kinds of tricks that the Jews in 1948 had to use in lieu of having enough weapons, because they don't. They don't have enough manpower. They don't have enough weapons. They don't have enough of anything. But somehow, the Egyptians are fooled into believing that there are more of them than there really are. And even though eight of the defenders are killed, and you can see their names here at the memorial. Eight of the defenders are killed, but they manage to hold out, and the Egyptians have to take a different route. They're not able to go through Kibbutz Nirim. They have to go around it. Eventually, there's a memorial built on the place with the same inscription, Lo Hatanki Natseach Ki Im Ha'adam. But Nirim holds off the Egyptians and manages to hold on to the site for another 6 months underground. The next place that they encounter on the road is one that's perhaps more famous than Nirim, and that's Yad Mordechai. Yad Mordechai is probably famous for the gentleman over here on the right. His name is Abba Kovner. He was a partisan. He was involved in the resistance in the Vilna Ghetto during the Holocaust, survived, came to Israel, and was one of the leaders of the fight in Yad Mordechai. The Egyptians get Yad Mordechai, of course, named for Mordechai Anilevich, the leader of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. So this is a very tough group of survivors who are here, and the Egyptians get to Yad Mordechai next. And Yad Mordechai, despite the fact that they are hugely outnumbered, they hold off the Egyptians for 5 days. The Egyptians eventually are able to get past them, but it takes 5 days until they can do that. Now, all of this resistance is actually extremely important, because what it means is that, first of all, the Arabs, the Egyptians, are reluctant after these two battles to go through Jewish areas. And so Jewish areas are spared. They go through Arab areas instead. And they also start to feel that, well, wait a second, maybe this isn't going to be as easy as we thought it was. And we're going to come back to that story when we get to the story of Ad Halom. Okay. But for a moment, let's keep looking back at some of the battles that are going on here. And one of them is Kibbutz Be'eri. Okay. Kibbutz Be'eri, of course, has been in the headlines way too much in the past few months, but was in the headlines then too. It's one of these 11 settlements. It was founded by the Noar HaOved VaHaLomed, right? Socialist youth, yeah, later joined by immigrants from Iraq. It's named after Beryl Katz Nelson, whose pen name was Be'eri. In 1948, there are fierce battles here, as you can see. After 1948, the original site of the kibbutz is not where they rebuilt. That's where you see these burnt-out buildings over here on the right, which are still there in the forest around Be'eri. Instead, they move the kibbutz 3 kilometers to the east, but the original place is still in the area around Erie, in the beautiful forests that are nearby. Also in the forest, you have what Erie and that area were famous for before October 7th, which is the beautiful, beautiful carpets of Calaniot, of anemones that cover this area in January and February, in the end of the winter, beginning of the spring, what's called here Daroma Dome. Also in the forest, you have a memorial to the Anzac fighters, the Australian and New Zealand fighters from World War I. You also have Byzantine cisterns, British Mandate sulfur mines. It's really a very interesting place. But when Kibbutz Be'eri rebuilds itself after the war, one of the early businesses, right? We think of kibbutzim in this area, we think of agriculture, but it's not only about agriculture. One of the early businesses here is a print shop, Be'eri Printing. Today, Be'eri Printing is one of the biggest and most important print shops in the country. They print everybody's driver's licenses. They print a whole bunch of government documents. And one of the signs of life in Be'eri after October 7th, amazingly, within a month after the massacre and the attacks, the print shop was up again, was up and running again, and is rebuilding itself. So that's a beautiful continuation of our story. Meanwhile, okay, let's go back to the Egyptians. They continue pressing onward, going north. Okay? They pass by through Yad Mordechai. They go through Ashkelon. They get to Ashdod. Ashkelon and Ashdod are small little Arab villages, nothing like what they are today. And when they get to Ashdod, they get to a very important bridge. Okay? It's called Jisr Ishdod, or the Gesher Ashdod, the Ashdod Bridge. Built by the Turks, spanning a riverbed. But 2 weeks earlier, May 12th, the Haganah had blown it up in order to stop exactly what was happening right now, any advancing army that wanted to go over the riverbed. And when the Egyptians get there on May 29th, they see that the bridge has been destroyed. They are not happy because in order to cross over the river, they're going to have to rebuild it. It's going to take time. They're exposed. They're very nervous. They don't understand that the Jews essentially have nothing, right? They are very worried that there are many, many Jews waiting for them, waiting, and besieging them and about to attack them. And adding to that fear is that Israel at that point, right, we're at the end of May 1948, we have finally managed to get hold of four planes, right? Four Messerschmitts that we bought from Czechoslovakia that were kind of out of commission after World War II. We bring them here, Azar Weitzman and the other pilots of the very, very, very new Israeli Air Force, take these planes and use them to bomb by the Egyptian Air Force, by the Egyptian army waiting at the bridge. They don't do very much damage, but they spook the Egyptians. They get very, very nervous. They're like, what's going to happen? Here, the bridge has been destroyed. We're being attacked by airplanes. The very next night, Jewish forces come and attack the Egyptian forces there. They also are not successful. But by this point, the Egyptians are sure that the Jews have thousands of soldiers waiting for them just beyond Ashdod. And they decide that they are going to retreat. Now, I brought you this map over here, right, just to give you a sense. Ashdod, 40 kilometers to Tel Aviv. The Egyptians essentially had the road open to them. They could have made it to Tel Aviv. They are spooked by the planes, by the bridge, by the battles, and they turn back. And Tel Aviv is saved. And in large part, that's because of the resistance that they found all along the way. The bridge, which eventually was rebuilt, was named Ad Halom. Ad Halom up until this point and no further. Okay. After the war was over, there was a memorial that was built here for the Israeli forces, right? Lalochamim shezaku ad halom. They cried out up till here. Naflu v'lo zachu. They fell and they did not get to see the success, the victory. But this is in their memory. But the other thing that's here, which is rather odd and fascinating, is This what you see here on the right, and this is an Egyptian obelisk, as part of the peace agreements that Israel made with Egypt, with Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin. Israel was allowed to keep their memorials in the Sinai, and they gave the Sinai to Egypt, but they could keep their war memorials. In return, Egypt was allowed to commemorate their fallen here at Gesher Ad Halom. So that's just a kind of a strange detail here, but the story of Ad Halom really is the story about us being able to hold back the Egyptians, even though we had almost no power. It's an amazing story. Some of the kibbutzim that survived, many of the kibbutzim that survived, rebuilt. Sometimes not exactly in the same place, but very close by, like we saw with Be'eri. Others didn't want to rebuild in the same place. It was too difficult for them. There was too much damage. There was too much destruction. One of the famous ones is Kibbutz Be'erot Yitzchak, which you can see. I brought you another nice little Google Maps here, right? The old Be'erot Yitzchak, this was a religious kibbutz. As we saw before, it was the staging ground for a few of these communities of the 11 Nekudot. They are relatively isolated. And when the war begins, the mothers and the kids were evacuated. I had a lot of similarities between this area and the area of Gush Etzion. They're shelled. And then on July 15th, 1948, the Egyptians attack them. They don't attack them in that first wave. They attack them later as part of their attempt to take the Negev. The Egyptians breach the fence. They capture some of the structures in the kibbutz. The Jews retreat, but they manage to fight back and they hold on until reinforcements can come, and shell the Egyptians. Ultimately, 17 Israelis were killed and 200 Egyptians. So the kibbutz was able to hold on, but you can see the great damage that's done here to the water tower. And even though they survived, they decided to rebuild in a different place, rather far away. Not far from Petah Tikva. This is Be'erot Yitzchak of today. However, on either side of the old Be'erot Yitzchak, you have two communities. One, a religious community, like Be'erot Yitzchak was, Kibbutz Alamim, and the other one is Nachal Oz, which we'll talk about in our next class when we talk about settlement here in the 50s and the 60s. Okay. Another community that we mentioned before, Nirim, moves also in an interesting way, right? If you take a look, this is where Nirim was in the beginning in 1948, right? This is the memorial that we saw, the Andarta of Nirim. This is on the land that was bought by Shlomo Dangur, but because the kibbutz suffered so much damage in the battles, after the war was over, they decided they were going to rebuild, but they didn't want to rebuild in the same place. And they moved really not very far away, 15 kilometers away. But what's interesting here is that on the area where Nirim was, a new community was built called Nir Yitzchak. This is very, very close to Kerem Shalom. This is very close to the border with Gaza and with Egypt. The new Nirim is right next to something we talked about last time, and that's the ancient synagogue of Maon. And all the pieces, Israel is always layers upon layers upon layers. This was discovered in the course of road work that was done to build roads out to these areas in the 1950s. If you remember from last time, we talked about this beautiful, beautiful synagogue mosaic from Byzantine times with all of these images of birds, of animals, of grapevines and olives, right? And the similarities between it and the church mosaics that were built around the same time. Okay, so that's Nirim, which also moved. Finally, and I apologize, I'm ending a little early today, throat bothering me. But finally, what we're going to do next time, right? We're going to talk about Ben Gurion's vision for the Negev. Ben Gurion really believed that the Negev was the future of Israel. He looked at, he would talk about, Abraham was the first Jew, the first Zionist, the first settler. Where does he go? He goes to Beersheba, right? He goes to the south. He, Ben-Gurion had many things that he said about the Negev. He said, you don't come as an immigrant to go and live in Tel Aviv. You come to build and to create and to be a pioneer. And he put his money where his mouth was when he retired, even before, but when he retired permanently, he went down to Stable Care, and he lived there. And this is a picture of him there. And next time we're going to talk about this Zionist mission of settling the Negev, how that was done, who were the people who were brought there, sometimes when they wanted to, and sometimes against their will. Right. So let's just take a look. We don't have so many questions this time, but let's see what we got. Sorry. Just going to open up. Oh, thank you. All these nice refuah shleimas. Okay, let's see. Let's go back. Why is it called Badlands? Badlands is not a, it's not a Hebrew term. It's like there's Badlands all over the world. Bitronot is like levater, like Brit Ben HaBitarim. Right, so it's like to cut in half, and it's meant to show how the land is kind of carved into almost these like sculptural shapes. So Bitronot, I think, actually is a more logical name than Badlands. I agree with you. Amin's interesting, right? I had the same question when I taught a class about nature. And we talked about almonds as one of the products of the land of Israel that survives even in drought years. And it's something that Jacob sends with his sons down to Egypt. I think almonds, wild almonds, are different than almonds that are cultivated. I don't know enough to say, but I know that almonds was a crop that they wanted to grow in Ruchama. Maybe the almonds that we grow here are different in their need. It's a good question. I don't know. Yes, victory, image of victory about Nitzanim. Yeah, it's a terrible story, the story of Nitzanim. I didn't want to go into it because it wasn't really our area so much, but yes, Nitzanim, surrendered. It was a very controversial thing in the early years of the state. Abba Kovner shamed them for surrendering. A complicated story, but yes, you can watch that movie and know more about it. The problem in modern times is there is no way to fool anyone. I'm not sure, but well, unfortunately, we were fooled. And yes, we can learn from their courage and from never giving up. And I think one of the things that's very important today when we're talking so much about these areas, and we're living in the midst of this history, and it's not an easy history to live in the midst of. Yesterday was a very, very, very hard day in Israel. But I think when we step back and we look at the bigger picture of what they accomplished and the setbacks that they had and the challenges that they had, which were enormous compared to our challenges, it really is something that can give us hope and can help us to see the bigger picture. The timelines, yes, I will send them to Rabbi Kelman to post them on the website. Or you can just screenshot them if you want. Thank you for all the Refuah Shleima thoughts. Yes, Steven Spielberg's sister, whose name is, I don't remember, but she did make a movie about the early Air Force. So, Nancy, thank you. Nancy, thank you very much. Yeah, so many amazing, amazing early stories. Okay, so everyone should have a good rest of the week. We should have Bisarot Tovot. And we will reconvene next week to talk about the early years of the state in our area of the Negev. Thank you, everybody.
Hey,
Feel
thank
well,
you.
feel better.
Thank you.
Thank you.